You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. Just me here today. No Mena van Praagh, I'm afraid. She's off meeting her publishers, doing exciting things like that. But Mena fans need not worry. She's here in spirit later on when she interviews Ellie Stoneley about Milky Moments, which is Ellie's rhyming pitch book for children about breastfeeding. And that's really just the beginning of quite an eclectic show that we've got for you today. We've also got an interview with Ruby Wax about mindfulness. And our studio guest today is Guinevere Glassford. Hello, Guinevere.
Hi.
Mindfulness, let's think about mindfulness really. Mindfulness, all about being still and in the moment. And writing's a little bit like that, isn't it? You have to get in the zone.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a great deal of thinking and thought involved with any piece of writing, and I think most writers would identify with that. In terms of mindfulness, it's interesting. Maybe the mindfulness comes after, because actually any piece of writing also raises an awful lot of questions, and I think that really requires you to be, not exactly still is what I'm trying to say. You know, it can be quite a sort of a frenetic activity as well in some ways. Begin to ask questions of, you know, why you're doing this, what's interesting about it. So to begin with, you are kind of locked up with your own thoughts and thinking. But then after that, you know, you go out and start talking to other people, to other experts, and getting a much wider picture. And then that all feeds back into it as well.
And so, do you know when you're having a good moment, as it were?
I do, there are definitely times when the writing is just there, or I think that the writing's just there, I have to say, but it feels very fluid, and I can write quite, you know, freely, but actually the important part obviously is the editing, and that's actually when you do find the true story that's there, and you go back to that work which you thought was fantastic and you think, oh my goodness, what's that? But that's why, you know, when you have a book published, you go through the editorial process. That really is there to enable you to get the best out of your writing.
Well, there's no writing, just rewriting, isn't that a famous quote?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, we're going to talk to you a lot about your debut novel, which has such wonderful reviews. But we'll start with your first piece of music, your first choice of music, which is Blue Moon Revisited by the Cowboy Junkies. Why have you chosen this one?
You know, I first heard this when it came out in 1988, so that ages me somewhat. And at that time in my life, I was working sort of a minimum wage job, long days. And I remember this coming on the radio and really feeling that I was absolutely in a rut, and I needed to do something with my life. And I think we all have this. And this is one of the things that interested me about writing about Descartes at this time as well, because it was a time of crisis for him in the 1630s. So this piece of music came on the radio, and I thought, enough of this. And, you know, within a year I'd been to night school and had enrolled on a history degree at Lancaster University that then had a very progressive attitude to mature students. And really, that was a turning point in my life. And so whenever I hear this piece of music, it takes me right back to that moment. And I think, oh, you know, I didn't know I was going to be a writer then. You know, history definitely came first. But all of that has enabled me to be sitting here today and talking about my book.
That was Cowboy Junkies and Blue Moon Revisited, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Guinevere Glassford. Guinevere's debut novel, The Words in My Hand, published earlier this year, has already garnered rave reviews. The Sunday Times called it a striking debut, and The Times named it their book of the month for January. Love Reading also declared it as their debut of the month. The novel tells the story, based on real life events, of the relationship between the philosopher Descartes and his Dutch maid Helena. Well, we're obviously going to talk about Descartes and Helena in a lot of detail, Gwyn, but first of all, those reviews. How did it feel to get those reviews?
Oh, I was thrilled, and totally unexpected as well. And I have to say, if no other kind word is said about my book, I'm happy with that. I really am.
Were you told to look for reviews by your publishers and by your agent, or to avoid them, or do they come to you anyway?
I mean, they come through anyway. But one thing I've learned, I mean, this is all new to me, but one thing I've learned is it's extraordinarily difficult to actually get any review at all. There are so many books being published. So to actually, you know, to have two reviews and two big broadsheets like that is fantastic.
And let's talk a little bit about the journey to publication of The Words in My Hand, because it was originally picked up by a German publisher, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It sold at the Frankfurt Book Fair in October of 2014, and it was bought by Ullstein, and it was their lead book going into the summer of last year. So it was published in towards the, when was it? I should know. August. Oh gosh, time goes. So yes, it was published in August, and the rights have sold obviously in the UK and have sold in another of other European countries too.
So when it was first picked up by a German publisher, that must have been quite exciting, but were you expecting it then to be picked up by a UK publisher?
I mean, I've come to not expect anything, I think, you know, and I was absolutely delighted when it sold in the UK. And I was also delighted when it sold, obviously, in the Netherlands and in France as well. It felt like those are really important countries for the book to be published in, because obviously, you know, Descartes, lots of people don't, well, I'm not sure that everybody knows this, but Descartes spent a significant part of his adult life living in the Netherlands because it was, you know, a comparatively safe country to live in at the time. But, you know, rights have also sold in Spain as well. So, and there's an edition coming out in Australia and New Zealand.
How exciting to think your book's being read around the world.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. It really is.
Well, let's talk about Descartes, because the novel's based on a true story. How did you first find out about this story?
Well, to begin with, I didn't know that I was going to write about Descartes. I had this structure in my mind. I wanted to write a novel in three parts, and I saw it almost as an equation, so that these three parts of the novel, by the time you got to the end of it, would make perfect sense in the way that an equation does, like x plus y equals z, which is completely ridiculous because I'm just like the worst mathematician.
It's a nice idea, though.
But it was, yeah. And I started just sort of reading around this. And this is one of the glorious things about writing, really, is right at the beginning of something where you are just sort of finding your way into it. And I thought X, Y, Z, oh, that's Cartesian, you know, that's Descartes. I studied Descartes when I did my history degree. As I started reading around Descartes, I found this reference to the fact that he'd had a daughter and this relationship with Helena Jantz, a Dutch maid, in the 1630s. And I thought, that's really interesting. Why didn't I know this? You know, if you look at like Wikipedia's page on Descartes, great long page, and Helena is just dismissed in a sentence. And, you know, that was the initial hook, was the why. And I think that's what novelists do. That's what they can do very well of histories, to begin to ask different questions. You know, why? Why is she, was she just been reduced to a sentence or two, or just to like a footnote in history? And the more that I found out about it, the more I realised actually this was probably a very significant relationship to Descartes, very important. She knew him at a very interesting time in his life, you know, before he was great, before he was published. And she may well have known him for a decade or more. And this is the time when he does publish, and perhaps when he's at his happiest. And that comes across quite strongly in his correspondence, which is one of the key research tools I used in the book.
What did you went to the correspondence? Where else could you go to look for information?
Well, the correspondence really was a primary resource. I mean, there's an edition that's published which is incomplete. In fact, there's a research team at the moment working on a new translation, a full translation of Descartes' correspondence. But that work's still ongoing. But otherwise, you know, I mean, I was on a mentoring program called Escalator with Writers Centre Norwich. And as part of that, I was awarded an Arts Council England grant, which meant I could then go off to the Netherlands. I could afford to go to the Netherlands. And I did a couple of research trips there. And I met an academic, one of the key academics who've been translating Descartes' correspondence, Dr. Erik-Jan Bos, who then became the academic advisor on the book. And so, yeah, so I was actually sort of, I took myself off to the key settings that I knew I wanted to have in the novel, you know, these places, you know, where following Helena's journey around the Dutch Republic. So not just Amsterdam, it's not just an Amsterdam book.
No, because it's not just based in Amsterdam, no. It goes to Leiden and Deventer, is that how
yeah,
it has it?
Yeah, that's right.
There's no correspondence left between Descartes and Helena.
No, and this was the other really intriguing piece of information that I came across was there's reference to Descartes writing to Helena in 1637 and anticipating her reply. It doesn't mean to say that she could write, you know, maybe somebody was writing on her behalf, but as a novelist I had to make the decision, could she or couldn't she write? I decided that she could, and that's one of the big themes in the novel is how she became literate. So yes.
Yeah, how does it feel to sort of try and create an image, a fictional image of Descartes? Because he's a kind of man whose name we know, but we couldn't necessarily say he's this, this and this.
No, indeed. I mean, it was profoundly challenging. I have to admit to that, you know, and there are other novelists who will not go near, you know, historical characters and well-known ones. I mean, for good reason. I mean, Helen Dunmore said that, you know, novelists who stray into this kind of area are in dangerous territory. And, you know, novelists should be very wary of putting words in the mouths of historical characters. And I absolutely get that. And there were times when I had real, I suppose, fear, you know, actual fear of it. You know, who was I to put words into Descartes' mouth? However, you know, putting that to one side, if I hadn't have done that, I couldn't have written this book. And I so wanted to tell Helena's story. I thought, you know, she seemed to have been written out of history. And the only way to sort of write her back in was really, I had to give a voice to Descartes. It took time. It took a lot of reading. I made a lot of mistakes. You know, all of that came through the editing process, I think. And actually, yes, I mean, I did find his voice in the end, you know. Maybe I got it wrong. I did the best I could, actually. But, you know, I actually drew on his correspondence because the man in his correspondence isn't this sort of dry, mechanistic, distant, cold figure at all. He's very, you know, witty and acerbic. He doesn't tolerate fools, you know. And all of that liveliness is in his correspondence, and I drew on that.
I think that comes through in the novel. He is very likable, but still quite mysterious as well, which I'm guessing you wanted to keep an element of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we'll talk more about Descartes. We'll talk more about Helena as well. We are going to just shift gear slightly, as I suggested at the beginning of the show, and talk about mindfulness and Ruby Wax. Ruby Wax is, of course, known for her extensive comedy and television career. But recently, she gained a master's degree in mindfulness-based cognitive behavioural therapy from Oxford University. Her new book, A Mindfulness Guide for the Frazzled, is based on her studies. She came to Cambridge recently to speak about mindfulness at an event organised by Heffers. I met her afterwards. She looked quite tired, I had to say, so I did ask her if she minded talking about mindfulness again to me.
Before I talk about it, it's sort of why I did it or why people do it. Obviously, I'm not going to go on about why we're stressed, you know, all the inner critical thoughts and the prestige of being busy. Clearly, we're living in another world here, but mindfulness is sort of a way that I found, and also I did a lot of scientific research because I wasn't going to go fluffy, is to be able to kind of navigate the noise, is to recognize where our tipping point is, and being able to focus when you need to focus, rather than being caught in those endless ruminations that keep you up all night. So that's why I picked it. Otherwise, I would have learned salsa.
I saw you talking about mindfulness about 3 or 4 years ago at the Hay Festival, when it wasn't really a word on everybody's lips then, whereas it's much more well known now. Were you just ahead of the curve?
For the first time in my life, I happened to hit the zeitgeist. That's never happened. I did a lot of research as to how to lower my stress or be able to focus, say, on my kids when I need, because I miss their childhood. I was always on the telephone. And I miss a lot of holidays. And when I eat really expensive food, I don't know if I'm eating it. So why waste the money? So I did research, and scientific research, it turned out that mindfulness and cognitive-based therapy had the best results. Also for depression and OCD and high anxiety and number of, so I found one of the founders of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and he was a professor at Oxford. So I said, I have to learn this. And he said, okay, you have to try to get in. He was laughing, but then I did. So I studied mindfulness at Oxford and then wrote this book.
Do you always do things that way? I mean, that's quite, some people say, I'll just investigate a little bit. You ended up doing an MSc.
I have a drive, which is good for me, but it also leads me to crash and burn. No, I did once try to get an acting job, and I was terrible in high school, but I didn't get in the RSC. I have a really good way of bluffing, but then I'm so driven and interested by the topic that it works out. I'm not interested in most things.
Well, you talk a lot about what drives you in the book. You talk about how you were motivated by rage at one stage, and you talk about your own depression and crushes. You're very candid in the book. You must have held something back.
Well, you know, I know enough to say, because it's also humorous in the book, what makes me do what I do. The book isn't about me, but it propels, hopefully, the reader to say, oh, yeah, that I would be interested in that, too. I go to parties like that, and I feel I have nothing to say. And then suddenly I'm talking to somebody and thinking, I don't know what I'm talking about. And I am actually bored with what you're talking about. So if you write about it in a humorous way, people identify. Or getting the constant reviews while they're doing things, that this isn't going to work, everybody's going to find out I'm a fraud. It's such a relief to find out other people have that. Now, those won't go away because that's part of the human package. But if, when you're in certain situations, if you can lower them a little bit, and with lowering the voices, the thoughts, you're also lowering your toxic chemicals, then that has a much more interesting repercussion, not just being present, but if stress goes down, so does cortisol, so your immune system has more of a chance of flourishing. And with a broken immune system, which you get from stress and stress alone, it creates diabetes, obesity, premature aging, all the problems we have now in the 21st century, it's because of the brain.
Well, you talk a lot about chemistry in the book, and you've obviously gone on a bit of a journey as you've written the book, to getting involved in the science and the psychology. Was that enjoyable?
I'm not fluffy. I can't do something on belief, or somebody tells me, or waving an angel card. I use that for humor, that self-help stuff. But to me, if the car breaks down and you're on a motorway, I want to know what's in the engine. I don't want to be helpless. So understanding that we all share the same plumbing, when the car needs to go into neutral, I might have a way of doing it, or at least I do an exercise for that, then I stand more of a chance of not burning out and living longer.
Was the one thing that you found out while you were doing the research for the book that really kind of shifted your view?
Well, the neuroplasticity means that the brain is always shape-shifting, that we aren't set, hard set, the way we thought we were. So I can't go, well, I'm kind of a lightweight, or then I'm an introvert, or I'm a victim. That's really how you perceive yourself. And it's possible to break down those habits, because they're just habits of thinking, I'm shy. Okay, you're shy. You shy all the time? No, not all. Okay, we shift. And that's sort of letting go, observing how you think. And by observing, it transforms. In the book, I have my brain scanned. Then I go in a retreat, silent retreat, for 6 days, and then I come out and have it scanned again, so I could use myself as a guinea pig. So you could see the different results of how less alarmed, how less vigilant you are. Now, that was extreme, but even if you do a few minutes a day, it starts to show. It does show up in the brain, and neuroplasticity takes place.
What are you going to do with your qualification? This is an amazing qualification.
I'm doing my qualifications. I'm writing a book, and I wrote a show. So that was always what I was going to do with my qualification.
So you're combining it with your entertainment?
Yeah, I wanted to do a hybrid of comedy and information.
And you talk in the book about how you believe mindfulness should be compulsory in schools.
It is in schools now. Kids, beside being academically brilliant, also need to understand themselves emotionally. Otherwise, those tests, those exams will burn them out. I mean, it's not my imagination that more kids are disturbed. They're doing cutting now. There's more alienation. So we need to do something to compensate. They need to learn more and more. As soon as they learn more and more, you have to have a way of being able to, for them to bring down their anxiety, because kids are frying.
And I suppose necessarily you've had to go deep into yourself when you're studying mindfulness and when you're talking and writing about it. Are you comfortable with that?
It's about observing your thoughts. Even though they're shallow, mine are totally shallow. I need bath towels, then I get that, then the perfect lampshade, then I get that. None of it's interesting. It's just garbage. But, you know, the human condition is we have that going on. So face it. Just watch it. And by watching it, you start to observe your thoughts rather than live at the mercy of them. You start to stand back a little, and the standing back enhances neuroplasticity. It means you're breaking your old habits. You're still you, but the really driven, disturbing things that lock you into one label or another start to decrease, transform.
And how do you practice it in your life? Is it something that you sit down and do every day, or is it something that you can do?
I have to do it every day, but the way I describe it in the book, if you're in a bus queue, if you're riding on the train, there's always minutes in the day where you're not doing anything except getting anxious that it's taking so long. So while you're waiting, you might as well do these really easy exercises, but the repercussions can be seen in a brain scanner. That's what keeps me going.
And the last three words of the book, I am awake. Mm-hmm. They're really inspiring. You're still feeling awake.
Thank you. Yeah, awake but tired. But I notice what goes on rather than just blindly elbowing my way through it.
And looking at the room today, it was a packed room, mainly full of women.
Yeah, that was strange, because in my shows it's half and half. I guess women, I don't know, I'm more appealing to them.
I wonder if it's a subject that does, you know, appeal more to women somehow.
Not really. Men are in more trouble than women are as far as stress. I don't have to say the statistics, but women are, it's easier for them to talk, but the men are really keeping it in. And in my shows, in the second half, they talk. A lot of men stand up because they don't have anywhere else to go.
And in terms of studying, you talked about how you're incorporating it into your work. You've done an MSc, is it?
Yeah.
MA. Are you going to do a PhD?
No, because that wouldn't make my shows any better. It's too detailed.
That's Ruby Wax there talking about her new book, A Mindfulness Guide for the Frazzled. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Guinevere Glassford. Interesting there, Ruby Wax talking about her journey into learning. She's learnt all these things doing this master's about neuroplasticity. I'm guessing that you are now very knowledgeable about Descartes.
Yes and no. I mean, I really focused in on a particular period of his life. And his correspondence, as I mentioned before, in fact, you know, covers decades. You know, very interesting body of work in itself. And I was very, you know, I was absolutely ruthless. I focused on the 1630s and the early 1640s because that was specifically of interest to the book.
And what I like is the way you do sort of combine, though, those thoughts that he was having about snowflakes and physics and all of that, that they're in his relationship with Helena.
Yeah, and I mean, the novel's written from her point of view, so we only ever see these things from her point of view, and that mattered to me too, because, you know, her view of the world is as important as his. It seems remarkable that I have to say that, but nonetheless, often these stories, often the woman will take, you know, she's the woman behind the man, rather. And in fact, actually, what mattered was to show her as a woman in her own right, with her own opinions, her own views of the world, her own experiences. And these are valuable and were valuable, I believe, anyway. Perhaps I'm just guilty of believing my own fiction, but I believe were valuable to Descartes. You know, a relationship came out of it, a relationship which lasted for a number of years, complex relationship, I think. But one that really clearly mattered to him. And I think that she mattered to him. And this is what the book tries to open up. But yes, I mean, there's all sorts in there about Descartes. You know, so the candles, snowflakes. You know, Descartes was one of the first people to describe snowflakes. And I wanted to humanise him, because actually when you think about what it takes to describe a snowflake, you know, centuries before we had photography, and it's difficult even to photograph a snowflake. So I imagined him out in the snow. And he publishes this in Discourse on Method in 1637, but actually it's based on his observations from 1634, 1635, when he was in Amsterdam, when he met Helena. So suddenly I had this scene in my mind of him out in the snow and her out in the snow catching snowflakes and studying them. You know, and I thought, well, actually, it's one way of bringing his science, or his thinking rather, into the novel, but also I hope it helps to bring him alive as well.
Very much so. They're lovely moments. They're lovely, and you learn something as well. So are we going to play your second piece of music now, which you brought in on a CD for us? This is from the CD La Chanson Bien Douce by Billy Carey. Why this one?
I love this, and I only came across it sort of 2 or 3 years ago. When I'm writing, we talk about stillness, I can't listen to music because I think it just distracts me and it takes away from the sort of the emotional intensity of working in the text. However, when I was editing, what I found was that I needed to take an absolute break from that. And I listened to this music again and again and again as a way of, I don't know, sort of centering my brain again, because I felt like I was just going off in so many directions with the copy edit. So this was absolutely brilliant for that.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today, Guinevere Glassford, here to talk about her debut novel, The Words in My Hand. And you're going to read for us now, Gwyn.
Yes, I am. This is a short extract from early on in the novel. So one of the central themes of the book is how Helena became literate. So that's one of the central questions I wanted to answer. And it was key to establishing her character as well and her backstory. So this scene, she's working as a maid for Mr. Sargent, who's an English bookseller in Amsterdam. And it looks at how she gets what she needs to be able to write. I was to prepare quills instead. Well, if that's what I was good for, then I was determined to be good at it. I stripped back the feather the way I'd been shown, cleaning it so there was no stubble. Mr. Sargent rubbed his thumb and forefinger together. It must be smooth, he said, so a thought has nowhere to snag. No excuse at all, no reason to tarry, trip, or stop. The first quills I prepared would have hooked whole paragraphs of words. I threw them straight in the fire. A quill has to have grace. A quill without grace is a duck, Mr. Sargent said, and laughed at his own joke. He made a great show of resting the quills I prepared in his hand, arms stretched out in front as though balancing a knife. Neither ink nor paper were needed for him to know if it was wrong. Duck, he said, and tossed it over his shoulder. Another, this time bring me a swan. That's how I knew, how I learned what a quill should be, and all of it had to be right before the nib was cut, sharp or blunt, a decision that changed everything too. It seemed 1 in 20 quills was good enough. The rest ended up on the fire or at his feet. Sometimes the floor round his chair looked as though he'd been preening, some days as though he'd been plucked. I swept at the quills that weren't wanted. It was a shame to waste them, I thought. I wondered which would suit my hand. I had quills, but no ink, nor paper, nor money for either. I ground up charcoal on the back step with a stone, then spent the rest of the afternoon scrubbing off the mess. Charcoal did not make good ink. Neither did soot. Blood clotted and clagged the nib. Cocoa wouldn't dissolve in cold water. Beetroot made lovely pink ink, but I had to boil the liquor almost to nothing, and Mr. Sargent complained of the stink. I did not dare take his tea, but dipped my quill in the dregs in his cup. Those words shone like amber, then faded as they dried until all that was left were their ghosts. Of everything I tried, beetroot was best. I had quills, and now I had ink, but no paper. Mr. Sargent had paper, but if I was caught with any of that, I'd be dismissed. I could not take it without asking, and if I asked, he'd want to know why, what I wanted it for. What would I say? I want to write, Mr. Sargent. I know you decided I couldn't, but I've decided I can. What would he say to that? I had to find something else to write on instead. But finding something other than paper made learning how to cut quills seem simple, and the making of pink ink an undertaking of the most ordinary kind. I tried everything to hand that wouldn't be missed or found. I wrote on old sheeting, on the table, on a plate. The sheeting, even when pegged flat like a canvas, soaked up the ink and the words bled into each other and fused into blobs. They looked like a line of piglets, but I refused to let the thought please me. I wrote on the table, but had to wipe the words off before they became stuck. A plate made the best page of all, but those words refused to dry and I lost patience and swilled the lot into a bucket. I baked a thin pastry crust, hard as a board, and would have written on that had Mr. Sargent not tried to eat it first. Then, late at night, after Mr. Sargent had gone to bed, and with nothing else to write on, I rolled up my sleeve. Those first words, the words that ran from the inside of my elbow to my wrist, were the most ticklish. When there was no more room, I lifted my skirt and wrote above my knee, then on my thigh. I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote.
That's lovely, lovely, vivid image there. Let's talk about research. Did you have to do a lot of research into beetroot and what makes good ink and what makes good vellum paper?
I mean, the beetroot was a happy guess. So I didn't actually boil up beetroot, but I thought, yeah, I mean, if you ever have boiled up beetroot, you know, I mean, it just leaches out into the water. So I thought, I remembered that. But yes, I mean, you know, things that we take for granted, you know, pens, paper, that sort of thing, were very expensive then. And girls such as Helena weren't taught to write. So that really was one of the key questions I needed to answer in the book, was how had she got to a point where she could have written to Descartes? It's interesting because girls were educated in the Dutch Republic at the time, but they were taught to read only, so they could read the Bible. It's only the wealthiest girls that were taught to write. So if you look at like the genre paintings and Vermeer's paintings, the maids in those paintings, you know, they pour milk. Vermeer's maid pours milk, or they're there in the background sweeping. And you do sometimes see some wealthy women writing, but predominantly then the written word still belonged to men.
What do we know about Helena then? What information did you have to work on there that she might have been able to write? She certainly corresponded with him somehow. What else did you know?
Well, you know, most of what's known is known through him, through Descartes. There are three instances that I know of, certainly, of her name in the archive. So one of which is on the baptism record for their daughter, who was born in 1635, and that record still exists, and her name's on that. And then there are two other records from 1644, 1645, which, you know, some years later, because she meets him, you know, a decade before in Amsterdam. So here she is, all that time later, still in his life. But otherwise, there's nothing there. But it's very interesting what is there, and I think it does point to a very, you know, a deep relationship, the fact that it persisted.
I suppose having a blank page is good in some way, because it gives you carte blanche, but you have got those boundaries to work within.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I had to get her voice. You know, that's key to me as a writer. And that did take time, as it did with Descartes as well. And then once I had her voice, you know, she really came alive. I felt like I wanted the reader to be right by her side in the story, to understand what her life was like, who she was or might have been before she met Descartes. That really mattered to me, you know, that, you know, it had to be her story. You know, what would it have been like to have been a single parent in the 17th century? I'd been a single parent myself, you know, for centuries. Societies have had problems with single parents, you know, and so that's another one of the themes in there. And that felt actually quite contemporary in some ways. But I wondered, you know, who might have helped her, who might have hindered her. And it was by asking all these questions, really, that brought the story to life.
Yeah, so thank you. Well, and also thank you because you're talking about motherhood there, which leads us nicely into our final interview of the show. Ellie Stoneley is the author of Milky Moments, a rhyming picture book for children about breastfeeding. Highly praised by the Royal College of Midwives, Milky Moments was published in May 2015, quickly selling out of its first print run. It's now been voted into the final of the prestigious People's Book Prize in the children's literature category. Mena met Ellie Stoneley in a cafe. Mena loves her cafes, but there is a little bit of background now, so apologies for that. And when she met Ellie, Mena asked her what inspired her to write Milky Moments.
When my daughter was born, I didn't think I'd be able to breastfeed because she had a tongue tie and she had to have a little nose tube to start with, and she was bottle fed, but I tried and I kept trying, and I was just amazed that every single book she was given had pictures of bottles in it. The doctors were saying, oh, you should try breastfeeding. All the posters everywhere around us, it was bottles, and you're watching EastEnders or whatever the soap, and it was all bottle-fed children. And there was just nothing with breastfeeding in. I forgot about it. We carried on breastfeeding, and she got to being 9 months old. She was christened, and for her christening, all the books she was given, bottle feeding. And I just sort of at that point thought, this is rather interesting. And so I did a bit of research. I found 5 books that had imagery of breastfeeding in, but most of them were themed around a certain thing. So whether it was nighttime weaning, whether it was preparing a second baby for a new one coming, whether it was giving up breastfeeding and how to get them onto ordinary food. And there was just nothing that just said, this is daily life, this is how life is day to day for so many people. And there was nothing really specifically focused at children around it, so that was where the idea came from. Hope carried on breastfeeding, which was something I never imagined. I thought I would be somebody that would do it for 6 weeks and then find it all a bit odd and stop. I didn't. She's 4 now and she still has breast milk at night sometimes, and that's fine. So I kind of wanted all of that to be part of it, so it was very much our journey was the inspiration.
And I love the fact that there's, you were telling me that there's real people in the book, that it feels very much like a community project, and you had the vision for it and you have a wonderful illustrator, but your friends are in it too.
There are six families. Every single one of the characters is named after a friend or a friend of my daughter's, and they're generally people who breastfed their children or children who were breastfed. All of them had sort of input into the book, so I asked them all about their experiences. We sat at play group, we sat at the Steiner School where my daughter went to school for a little while, and we just chatted about different people's experiences, what touched them, what moved them, what they struggled with, different places they'd fed, if they've ever had any negative comments and that sort of thing, what kind of clothes they wore to breastfeed in, what they felt comfy with. And then as the book sort of progressed and evolved, the ladies that had advised me about breastfeeding, I took the pictures to them and said, is this the way that you should hold a baby? And generally they said no, so we repainted them, and occasionally they said yes, but so they sort of fed into it. So I love the idea that the people that had really helped me to breastfeed actually helped the book become the book it is.
There's a real swell of feeling behind the book.
There is. I was amazed, because I find it quite humbling to imagine something I've created could touch people in that way. The words that they use are kind of their everyday life reflected in a book, and something that they do and their children see as normal that isn't normally in a book, and their children just able to flick through the books. And I even had an email this morning actually from a lady saying she's having to ration her daughter's reading of it because it's the only book that she will have read.
Very good review.
It's an amazing review. It's never had anything other than 5-star reviews, apart from one lady who said she couldn't buy it because there were too many nice fathers in it, and she was buying it for a single mother friend. And I said, well, actually there are a couple of single mothers in there as well as for your more nuclear family.
And so tell me about the awards.
There's a thing called the People's Book Prize, which is a bit like Strictly Come Dancing or The X Factor, so it's all sort of voted for by the public. It has 4 voting rounds, so I was put forward for the autumn vote against 12 other books. It was the top most voted for children's book, so it's gone through to the final, which is in May, so we need to mobilise a frenzy of public voting around Cambridge in May for it to be the children's book of the year, which is just unbelievable. And the comments that people have written, if you go to the People's Book Prize and just look in the children's section, find Milky Moments, and they're so warm and they're so encouraging, and comments from children, from adults, from elderly gentlemen that are delighted that their granddaughter's been able to find a book like this. And yeah, just really quite moving.
Because obviously it's quite autobiographical, and that there was a father that can't get through one of the little stories without crying because he relates to it so much.
Yeah, when my daughter was born, she was blue and she was doing something called grunting, which at the time I thought was a very sweet little noise and a baby breathing, but actually it was the sound of her lungs collapsing. And I was poorly, so we ended up being in hospital for quite a long time, and so I really wanted one of the images to be of a baby kind of about to leave hospital who'd got through her illness by being breastfed, which is basically sort of what happened to my daughter. That particular illustration isn't actually one of my favourite pictures the way it turned out, but beyond any of them has touched people. And yes, I had a lovely note from a father saying he can't get past reading it out loud without crying. It does seem to touch people. Funny story, the second illustration in the book is a picture of a child's third birthday party, and I had an email from a lady called Jennifer who lives in Austin in Texas, and she said, I've decided to offer my son a Milky Moments third birthday party. And she sent me an email the next day saying that she'd suggested to him he had a Toy Story party, a dinosaur party, and he'd chosen this 3-year-old boy to have a Milky Moments themed birthday party based around this illustration, which has very colourful bunting, a spotty tablecloth, buns, which subsequently everybody says look like breasts. At the time, it wasn't actually part of the plan. And she recreated this entire scene, and she sent me all the photos from the party. The children have pointy, shiny hats, the tablecloth she hand-painted, and then somebody else has had their christening themed around the book. And again, it's just people that are really proud that they breastfeed, want their friends and family to know that, but want it in the context of a book.
Could you ever have imagined, when you were writing this book, what a reception it would get?
I spotted a niche in the market that there really wasn't anything out there. But then I just thought, well, the nagging fear was that if there wasn't anything out there, it was because nobody wanted it. But I really was very nervous, and I spoke to an agent who actually said, well, you know, everything's been written already, so of course it's not needed, and she was quite dismissive. But it seems that there is this niche out there, and it has filled it, and it is what people want.
So you must be very glad that you followed your intuition, that you followed your desire to write this book.
I am, and I'm very, very flattered that people have taken it to their hearts. I have been told by many people that the book's got legs, so it'll be around for some time to come because there will always be people breastfeeding, so hopefully that will keep it sort of rolling along. The first edition that came out was a beautiful, beautiful hardback edition, and they only produced very low numbers of those, but they sold out in 2.5 months, and so they were caught completely short. And I had a lovely email from the publisher, a very sort of embarrassed email, saying, "We have been caught short by this, I'm terribly sorry, we'll bring the paperback publication forward." And then that sold out, so they had to get the hardback and the paperback edition republished. So hopefully it's just kind of selling steadily. It's on websites, you know, from Australia to Romania. I don't think it's in so many bookshops yet, so that's something I'm on a mission to accomplish, to get it into Heffers and Blackwells and Waterstones and everywhere. But lots of the local shops in Cambridge are doing it. Yeah, slowly but surely. It's a lot of work for a mother of a young child to be getting on with, but it's something that I really believe in, and it just matters to get it out there.
And you were telling me about the pictures and the words going up. Was it the Ipswich Hospital?
It is. And that came from one of the midwives there. She approached me through the Facebook page saying, "We love these pictures and we've thought this might be a nice idea." And early this year they'll be up in the maternity unit, which is just wonderful, the idea that people be sitting there wondering what to do and which way up to hold their child, and they'll be able to look at the wall for inspiration. And it also then means that it'll go into the hospital shop. The Royal College of Midwives, I met the director doing a television interview last year, and she's become a great ally, and she gave me a wonderful quote for the back of the book, and she's reviewed it in the African Journal of Midwifery and on behalf of the Royal College of Midwives. The fact that midwives are behind it as a teaching tool, because all of the holds, the way that people hold the babies when they're feeding, are all sort of anatomically correct and the way that you should hold a baby.
So it's an inspirational book and a lovely book, but also something of a manual as well.
And also just realise that they can carry on. You don't have to stop at 6 months, or you don't have to stop at a year or 2 years. You can just sort of carry on as long as your child needs it and you're feeling able to breastfeed for. It's very autobiographical in that sense.
You were saying that you were going to write a trilogy.
Oh, I'm hoping to, and I've started work on a second one. So yes, there'll be a whole series of other books, starting with M, something moments and something else moments, and hopefully using the same family, and hopefully working with Jess, who's the most wonderful artist. Keeping with the sort of the attachment parenting theme, there will be breastfeeding women in the other books. I don't want it to sound like a sort of manual. It is a book that's just great fun for children. There's a little teddy bear in the book called Eric, who appears in every single picture. There's always something for children to look for, so it's great fun, as well as having this kind of breastfeeding thing going on. So it's not a book that says, "This is what you should do, this is how you should do it." It's just a lovely children's book to read and snuggle up with. Even if you don't read it, the children can hunt for the teddy or can find the chicken on various pages, or, you know, whatever it is, they can use it as a play book as well.
That was Ellie Stoneley there, author of Milky Moments, talking to Mene van Praagh in what sounded a very busy cafe there. I've got our studio guest, Guinevere Glassford, in the studio. Gwyn, now your book's out there and you've had to say goodbye to Helena and Descartes. How's that felt?
Well, I think I've got a bit of emptiness syndrome, to be honest. I miss them, I have to say. Although I do feel ready to move on. And in fact, actually, I am working on a second book. So that's keeping me occupied.
What's the second book?
Well, the second book is completely different. And it's based in, it moves between 1984 and 2014. It's called The Index of Lost Colours. And it follows one woman's story as her first love returns into her life.
Oh, lovely. It is strange, though, isn't it, when you release your characters out into the world, what other people make of them. Have you found, because you're a debut novelist, there's that label applied to you, does that give you and them protected status, or is everybody looking really closely at them?
No, everybody's looking really closely at them. I think there's been a good deal of interest in the book because it's ostensibly about Descartes and this period of his life about which very little has been written. So yes, there is interest in it, definitely.
Have you had a reaction from scholars, Descartes scholars?
Yeah, and you know, I haven't. Actually, it's been very good. I mean, I think it shows the limits of the archive and just how male a lot of history is. You know, if you were to write a history of Helena, it'd be a very short one. Well, I mean, and that's shown by how little of the stories covered in histories and biographies of Descartes. But I think, you know, novelists, you know, historical figure, I thought a lot about this. There was that spat between Niall Ferguson and Jane Smiley last year when he described historical fiction as kind of like a sort of secondary in many ways, you know, so it's like history's primary and historical fiction's secondary. And I think it's not a fair distinction to make. You know, they're different forms. So, you know, I don't think historical fiction's a secondary form. I think they're just different forms. It's like saying, you know, like an apple's better than an orange. No, they're just different fruit. But, you know, so I think, you know, historical fiction has got a very important role to play, because actually what it does is it will look, you know, we look very closely at history. It's obviously our novels are based on history. But I hope, you know, in doing so, that it might send historians back to the archive, or to get them to look again, perhaps, and, you know, and really assess the significance of this relationship in Descartes' life.
And on a practical level, you did a creative writing MA. You mentioned the escalator scheme that you did there, and you did a course at Faber as well. Could you have written the novel without those?
You know, actually what it comes down to is support. Certainly, the mentoring programme was hugely supportive of my development, and it enabled me to take my writing seriously. That's what it did. I think otherwise, you know, I would have been writing, there's no doubt about it, because, you know, I'd reached a point in my life where I realised that's what I wanted to do. But what the mentoring programme with Writers' Centre Norwich, Escalator, and all of that, enabled me to take my writing seriously, enabled me to move it really from the periphery into the centre of my life. And that was a fundamental shift for me. It also gave me a deadline to work to. You know, I had funding from Arts Council with a deadline. You know, I needed to get a first draft done by October 2013. You know, and I took that very seriously. You know, they'd funded me. There's hardly any funding left these days because of this government, which is very short-sighted, I believe. But it gave me a deadline to work to. And I think without it, you know, I may well have written the book, but it would have taken years, I think.
Well, I'm glad you did. It's The Words in My Hand by Guinevere Glassford. It's a great read. I do recommend it. Thank you ever so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with your next project. We'll just end with a piece of news. And actually, this is an organisation kind of close to your heart as well, Gwyn. Words and Women. You do the Twitter feed for Words and
Women. I do.
They're launching an anthology and celebrating their fifth anniversary on International Women's Day, which this year is on March the 7th. That's at Norwich Arts Centre. They have a competition every year, which is open to women writers, and they pick a winner and the best runners up and publish them in an anthology. So if you want to go along to that, find out more about that, then go to their website, which is wordsandwomen.co.uk. Is that the right website?
That's
yes,
right.
Or the Twitter feed, I think you can find it. But we'll play out now. Let me just preview the next show before we go. Our studio guest in the next show is travel writer Sarah Woods. We've also got interviews with poet and novelist Gabriel Badamozi and Christine Corton, who's written a book about the London fog. So we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Gwyn, which is the Maccabees and Something Like Happiness. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, it was interesting when you asked me to choose some music. I mean,
everybody hates it. Everybody always comes back to me and says, oh, no.
Oh, it was great. I spent like a whole week listening to music I hadn't listened to for ages. And I suddenly realised, actually, it's not just about my past. It's about where I am at now. So this is from a CD I only bought about a month ago, and I'm listening to all the time. And I just love it, you know, and it's about looking forwards.